In this hour of the program, we'll be talking with Bart Ehrman. He is a leading authority on the early Christian church and also on the life of Jesus. He's the author of more than 20 books, including the New York Times bestseller, Misquoting Jesus. He says that for most of his life, he was a committed Christian. After graduating from the Princeton Theological Seminary, he actually even spent a year as pastor of the Princeton Baptist Church. However, he says that he found that many years of close Bible study began to raise doubts in his mind about Christianity and perhaps even undermine his faith. But he says it was the problem of suffering that ultimately caused him to leave Christianity altogether. This is something that he explores in a recent book that we'll be talking about. And the title of his book is God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. It's published by Harper One, which is a division of HarperCollins. Our guest is the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's been widely interviewed and lives in Durham, North Carolina. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome. People who would like to join the conversation can do that easily by picking up the telephone and calling us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you'd like to call in, you can do that. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving along. But anybody is certainly welcome to call. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Ehrman, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me on your program.
Thank you very much for talking with us. And by the way, am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
You are.
Good, all right. I just wanted to check. I wouldn't want you to be wincing there every time I said it if I was saying it wrong. Well, to begin, as you do in the book, I think it would be interesting and perhaps important for people to know just a little bit about more about you, to talk about how it is you arrived at the point where you are now, and indeed in your growing up and for a lot of your life, you were a dedicated Christian, an evangelical, someone who certainly was a believer and intended, I think, probably from some early point to go into a life that was going to be involved with theology one way or another, right?
Yeah, no, that's right. Your introduction summed it up fairly well. When I was in high school, I had a born-again experience and went off after high school for my college to Moody Bible Institute, a fundamentalist Bible college. And then I went to Wheaton College for to continue my degree, which is the alma mater of Billy Graham. So I had very solid evangelical Christian credentials. I ended up going to Princeton Theological Seminary because I was interested in studying the Greek manuscripts of the New Testament and ended up doing a divinity degree there as well as then a PhD in New Testament studies. And so that's how I started out, with very solid Christian credentials. But as you pointed out, my study of the Bible started creating doubts for me as I dug deeper and deeper into the text in the original Greek and Hebrew languages, and I started doubting a lot of things that I believed. But it was finally actually this problem of suffering that did me in, that made me come to realize at a point about 9 or 10 years ago that I really couldn't believe in the Christian God anymore.
And this is, I think also you explain in the book that this this was a book that perhaps you intended to write or thought about writing. You began thinking about this actually some time ago. So it sounds as if you've been wrestling with these particular issues in your own mind and in your teaching now for a number of years.
Well, that's right. I was actually teaching at Rutgers University in New Jersey and was asked to teach a class called The Problem of Suffering in the Biblical Traditions. And what I did in this class was introduce the students to a range of answers found in the Bible as to why people suffer. I was struck at the time just at how many different answers there are in the Bible. Many of these answers are not ones that people hold to today. And even more interesting, many of these stand at odds with one another. So the Bible doesn't say just one thing about suffering. It says lots of different things, and some of these views seem to be at odds with one another.
And that, I suppose that it would be, in the essence, what the difficulty that you had with the Scripture as you spent more and more in time reading it, because it is the case on a lot of things. The Bible says different sorts of things, and depending upon who you read. And I think it was that led you to think more and more about the Bible being a collection of writings by people, by
yes.
humans, and who knows how many and who knows when, that were put together to satisfy, in some cases, political realities of particular times, so that becomes something that, as you read it more and more, it, I guess, becomes more and more difficult to puzzle out, well, is there some sort of coherent message here?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The more I studied the Bible, the more I realized that it isn't speaking in one voice, but according to different situations, and they have different opinions and different beliefs and different perspectives, so that it's not right to take the book of Job and assume that he's saying exactly the same thing that the book of Amos is saying. In fact, they're saying things that are quite at odds with one another. Or in the New Testament, it's not right to think that the Gospel of Mark is saying the same thing about Jesus that the Gospel of John is saying. They're in fact saying very different things. And so this opened up to me the richness of the Bible, that it isn't simply one message. There are lots and lots of messages. And the striking thing, of course, is that some of these messages don't stand together. They're at odds with one another.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can talk basically here just about the problem of suffering just for a moment to make sure that people know what it is we're talking about. And this is something that is a problem that Christian theologians have wrestled with for a long time, but not just Christian theologians. It's a problem for people of many different religious traditions, for people who think about that, for philosophers and so forth. And I suppose if you're the kind of a person who believes that there is no order, there is nothing but chaos, stuff just happens, well, then you can say, well, then suffering just happens and that's that. But if you believe that there is a God, that God has power, that God is not interested in inflicting suffering, or at least that wants his or her people to be happy and to live well, then you come up against this big problem and say, well, wait a minute. If those other things are true, then where does the suffering come from? Does it come from someplace else? Is that what God intended? Is God responsible? Again, this is the kind of thing where if you ask different people, you're going to get a lot of different answers. And even if you go to Scripture and ask that question, you're going to get a lot of different answers.
Well, that's exactly right. The philosophical problem is that is the way you expressed it. There are three statements that in the Judeo-Christian tradition, each of which is normally taken to be true on its own, but when you put the three together, there seems to be a contradiction. The three statements are that God is all-powerful, and that God is all-loving, and that there's suffering. Well, how do you explain that? I mean, if God's all-powerful, it means he can do anything that he wants, and so he can prevent suffering. If he's all-loving, he certainly doesn't want people to suffer, and yet they're suffering. And so what people do in order to deal with this problem is they either deny one of those three statements, or they come up with some kind of extenuating circumstance to explain how there can be suffering, even given the power and love of God. And so a lot of people have very simple answers to this. And, you know, over the last few weeks since my book was published, I've gotten hundreds of emails from people who want to give me the answer. and in about, 12 lines of email, they can tell me the answer to the world's greatest problem, which I appreciate. But in fact, these are very complicated issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's also interesting that apparently you talked about the fact that when you would go around and you would meet people and there would be these introductions and they'd say, well, what do you do? And you'd say, well, I'm a historian of Christianity. And they'd say something like, well, what are you doing right now? And you'd say, well, I'm working on this important question here about why there is suffering. And then pretty quickly, they'd want to either move on or move on to some other subject. Or I suppose there might have been those people who had said, well, I can answer that question for you. But it seems to be the kind of thing that mostly people just would rather not
Yeah, it's a real conversation stopper at a cocktail party. You know, if you tell somebody you're writing a book on suffering, so that's exactly right. They either change the subject right away, or else they tell you in 20 seconds or less what the answer is.
Right. Saving you all that trouble of, yes, of right, figuring right. that out.
Why bother to write a book? You can just explain it in 20 seconds. Right?
Well, the book then it does indeed explain this in attempts to explain this in some depth, or at least looks at the various kind of explanations that are offered in the Bible. The book is titled God's Problem: How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. The book is published by Harper One, which is a division of HarperCollins. And our guest, Bart Ehrman, is the author. He is a professor of religious studies at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, has authored more than 20 books. And one he's probably best known for is Misquoting Jesus. He's written a lot about the history of the early church and the life of Jesus. And questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. What you set out to do here was to go through the Bible and look for answers to the question. And there are a number. And I suppose that the place to start is in the Old Testament with some of the earliest references to this. And so initially the question that it offers, well, why is there suffering? Well, it's because human beings are sinful, because they have turned away from God. They have not lived according to the principles that he set down for them. And that so suffering is punishment. I suppose it goes all the way back to original sin, at least. I don't know if we can go back any further than that. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah, this is probably the most prominent answer that you get in the Old Testament, starting, of course, with Adam and Eve, who are punished for eating the fruit from the tree that was forbidden, and throughout the pages of the prophets, all the prophets of the Old Testament, whether you're talking about Isaiah and Jeremiah or Amos, Hosea, and any of the prophets, they all basically say that the reason the people of God are suffering is because God is upset with them. They've done things wrong, and God is punishing them in order to get them to turn back to him. This is a view that people continue to have today. Whenever anybody, something bad happens to somebody and they say something like, you know, what did I do to deserve this? You know, the implication is that that their suffering has come because of something that they've done. Even though this is a very prominent answer in the Bible, I should point out there are other authors of the Bible who think that this answer is wrong and try to oppose this answer, and it really is a bit of a problematic answer. I think it creates a lot of false guilt among people who blame themselves for evil things that happen to them, and I think in many cases this is altogether needless and probably inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a couple of callers here, and I want to get them into the conversation here, but I guess just to underscore what you just said, that in the Bible there are a number of answers. This may be the original answer, that is, it's punishment for sin. It may be punishment of God. It may also be, in a sense, suffering that one person inflicts on another, which still ultimately is, I suppose, about sin. Also, there are people who will make the argument that they're trying to pull something good out of it, and they say essentially that as a result of suffering, lessons can be learned. That's that argument that says, well, suffering makes you better, makes you stronger. There are people whose answer is, well, we don't know what the answer is. Maybe it will be revealed to us sometime, but they seem to believe that there is one. And then I suppose another major position is the one that says, well, there really is no answer.
Yeah.
So you might as well stop looking for one, because and that may be the, in a sense, the easiest one to grab onto and the hardest one to deal with both, that one that says, well, you might as well give it up because you're not going to find an answer.
Yeah, well, you're right. All of these answers are in the Bible, and I think people need to evaluate these answers as well as try and struggle with the questions themselves, as people, thinking people, always have. I mean, I think this is, as long as there have been thinking people, there have been people who have wondered about why there's so much misery in the world, or at least why they're experiencing so much misery.
Well, we have several people here. Why don't we get them into our conversation? We'll start with someone in Champaign and someone who is on line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have two examples, and I The first one is that my daughter and her husband have a severely handicapped child, and they are the best parents. They take care of their three children in a fantastic way, and they are good people, so I can't see that suffering thing for them. And as far as I know, they follow all the precepts of their religion and Christianity. And I have heard people say, well, God never gives you more than you can handle, which I think is such a self-righteous, ugly statement. And then the second is my husband and the woman he was going out with while we were married are now married, and she seems to be very happy, and they are both doing well. And so that suffering thing doesn't apply to them. And it's like two separate examples, and nothing seems to apply to them. And I have serious problems about it. I still believe in God, but religion doesn't do it for me anymore to the extent it did. What's your answer?
Right. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'm sorry about those moments of pain for you. Your examples are very interesting, because the instance of your grandchild is obviously a kind of suffering that nobody wills. It's not something that somebody planned or wanted. Whereas the pain of a loved one who in an estranged relationship, obviously, when a spouse has a relationship with someone else, that is a matter of the will. Somebody chooses to have another relationship, and that creates great pain for the person with whom they're already related. And so I think any answers to suffering have to deal with both kinds of suffering, both those that happen just by acts of nature, whether birth defects or tsunamis or hurricanes or earthquakes or famine or whatever, and others that have to deal with the free will, that some people do awful things to other people, including such things as genocides and the Holocaust and whatever. And that's the value of the Bible, I think, is that the Bible actually has a range of answers for different kinds of suffering, and there isn't sort of one answer fits all. But all of these answers, I think, have to be evaluated for how adequately they deal with the problems that we face.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. And I think that the examples the caller gives are good ones, and probably most everybody can think of some kind of example, either from their life or someone that they know, where there has been suffering, and there doesn't seem to be any justice in it. And it seems to me that that's how it is that this first kind of answer to this question, that ones that appears fairly early in the Bible, that is, you know, punishment for sin, while there are still people who would embrace that and would say, yes, that is the explanation, that would be a big reason for people going out and looking for other explanations, because there is no justice in it.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And, you know, myself, I'm no longer a firm believer in the Bible as an agnostic, but I do think that the book of Ecclesiastes is a very wise book. It's the book that I like the best when it comes to this issue of suffering. And its view is basically that we can't understand a lot of what happens in this world, and that there is a lot of pain and misery in this world, but there's also moments of joy and happiness, and we ought to grab for life for all it can give us, because this is all there is. It's not going to be worked out in the afterlife. You're not going to be rewarded or punished afterwards. This life is all we have, and so we should live it to its fullest while we can, and we should work to resolve the suffering of others as much as we can while we're in the short life of ours.
Yeah, there we've sort of cut to the chase. That is the ultimate conclusion that you come to, and I think you recognize that maybe it's a little ironic, given that your doubts and questions about Christianity and about what it says in the Bible, that you would manage to at least find some harmony with one of the explanations, one of the answers to the question that is offered in the Bible, and it's that one.
Yeah, it is a bit ironic, although it is the book that people don't read very often because it's so different from the rest of the Bible, especially from the rest of the Old Testament, the book of Ecclesiastes. Mm-hmm. But I think it's a very powerful statement about how we should live life for the moment.
Let's go to another caller. This is Champagne in line two. Hello.
Yes, I first wanted to thank you for the book. I believe the question is extremely important given the amount of suffering that's going on both across the globe as well as locally in some of these communities. But as people begin to try to reach for the Bible to explain these things, as you point out, the problem is that a lot of the answers that the Bible gives is in conflict with one another. And so my question to you is, how much of this conflict that you find in the Bible is really due to the fact that, as you point out, that it's written by a bunch of different people with a bunch of different agendas, politically and otherwise, during a bunch of different time periods, and plus you have some changes that went on in the Bible as well. And so is it the case that given all of these changes and all of these differences that people come to, that the authors came to the Bible with, that you're really just not going to find a very satisfying answer in that book? And is there a more consistent book that people can begin to reach to try to find a better answer? I guess part of my question is because as you have come to a conclusion that you're no longer kind of a believer in the Bible as it is that the conclusion that most intelligent people should come to?
That's a great question. You know, people wonder about that with me. If I have ulterior motives, that what I'm really trying to do is to make everybody an agnostic like me. And the answer to that is no. I'm really not interested in people giving up their faith or losing the way that I did. What I am interested in doing, though, is getting people to think about their faith if they do have faith. If they're Baptists, I want them to be more thinking and thoughtful Baptists. If they're Presbyterians, more thoughtful Presbyterians. If they're Mormons, I want them to be thinking Mormons. And it may be that some people, as they devote themselves to more thought, will in fact see some of the problems within their own religious traditions. But I think that your assessment about the Bible is right, that you have all of these different answers because they're written by different people living at different times in different situations. And so, of course, they have different views on such important issues as to why they're suffering. I don't think that there's some other source that people can go to that's going to be better than the Bible. I mean, I think that people ought to read widely in the great literature of our civilization. And so I think people should read the Bible. I think they should read Shakespeare. I think they should read Plato. They should read Charles Dickens. I think that we should read and interact with some of the great minds of our civilization as we try to come to grips with understanding life and our place in the world.
Hmm. Well, again, I appreciate the comments of the caller, and I have a number of others, and I feel like I need to get on. I wonder whether how would you react to the idea that there can't be one answer to the question, why is there suffering, because there's not one kind of suffering, in this sense, that you might say that there's one answer to the question of, well, why are people suffering in Darfur? And there might be another answer to the question was, well, why was New Orleans wiped out by the hurricane? And then there might be another answer to the kind of question like, well, why did I get cancer?
Yes.
It's maybe you can't, maybe there isn't one answer to all those questions.
Well, I think you're right. I don't think there can be one answer. And I think that every situation has to be looked at on its own merits. And, you know, for example, you know, we live in a world today where every 5 seconds there's a child that starves to death. And even something like that doesn't have an easy answer. I mean, it used to be, you know, hundreds of years ago, that people starved to death simply because it didn't rain and there would be a drought and there would be no food. But today, there's plenty of food to feed the world, and the reasons tend to be more political rather than having to do with the climate. And so, even for for one set of suffering. There are multiple answers, I think, and no one should settle for sort of a simple solution to such complicated problems.
Let's talk next with somebody in Belgium over in Vermilion County, line number 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. The logic seems that this should happen, because if you think about the original authors in Nicaea were put into a situation that they already had a very diverse religion that they were trying to make all-inclusive, including to bring in all the people they could think about bringing in the future times, that they made it just as obscure as they possibly could in every way so they could reach every type of person. Doesn't that make sense?
You're talking about how we got the Bible with so many different voices represented in
exactly.
it? Exactly. Yeah. No, that's right. I wrote a book a few years ago that was called Lost Christianities. And what I tried to do in that book is something similar to what you're saying now. I tried to show how it is we got these books in the New Testament and why other books weren't included. And a lot of it wasn't simply because these books were inspired and the others weren't. It was because there were a lot of struggles among religious leaders in Christianity over what should be believed and what should not be believed, and that these struggles led to the formation of our canon, but it meant that there were a number of different views represented within the canon. And so I think that this is absolutely right, that's one of the reasons that we have so many different voices within the Bible.
And that, therefore, allows people to apply that same book, which was going to be the only book of that group, because that they wanted one book to use as a reference, that was made such a way so today we can make all kinds of conclusions because of its vagaries.
Yeah, well, you know, I think since probably for the last 300 years, scholars have read the Bible very differently from the way they used to. The way people used to read the Bible, biblical scholars, was to assume that it had all come from God and was all speaking with a unified voice. And I think for the last 250 years, scholars have realized that, in fact, another way to read the Bible is to give each author his own integrity and let him say what he wants to say. And when you do that, you realize that, in fact, there are these wide range of voices in both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Well, is it the case, though, that if you have that kind of base of scholarship to draw on and you understand something of, you might not know precisely who it was that wrote a particular book, but that you have some kind of idea who that person was, when they lived, what was the historical context of the time, and so forth, that in that case it's not so mysterious that you would say, we really don't know what it is this person was trying to say.
Yeah. No, it's very important. Something that's stressed by scholars of the New Testament and the Hebrew Bible, that you try to establish the historical context of a particular writing, because if you take the writing out of its own original context, it's what happens whenever you take anything out of context. You change what it means. One of the reasons there's so many disagreements about the meaning of the Bible today is because everybody takes it out of context. And the thing to do as a historian is to try and understand what the original context was so you can understand better what the author was trying to say.
Let's talk next with someone in Effingham, someone on cell phone. Line 1, hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Salute you and your guest for such a provocative topic. Wonderful. I agree there's probably no... easy answers, no easy one answer, and probably a lot of discussion, so I really appreciate it. Just a couple of quick observations since the clock is running here. I'm not a very religious person. I probably a lot of that had to do with being raised Catholic on the south side of Chicago and went through a lot of ritual and a lot of symbols and a lot of dogma. And I got a little bit older. I said, well, you know, is this really what religion is all about? And what I found is if you get into a discussion about religion, some people become very agitated and like to come up with quick answers. And I'm guessing it's because maybe they're insecure in their own beliefs, and perhaps you're threatening them by being provocative and questioning. Just very simply, I have two small children who are going to church, and trying to get them to look at the Bible not as a history book, but perhaps as, provocative manual and something that makes us think about religion. And it's very hard for them to, they're young, and it's very hard for them not to take it literally. We're frustrated, my wife and I, with our pastor, because his answer to everything is Jesus died on the cross. And we're like, well, okay, but, you know, what about this and what about that? And so I salute your observations in such a wide breadth of a topic here, and thought I would just put my two cents in. Thanks.
All right. Well, I don't know if you want to react to that in any particular way.
No, not in particular. I appreciate his comments, and I understand the problem. a lot of people have had very similar problems over the years with their churches, both Catholic and Protestant. So I appreciate what he had to say.
Yeah, I think sometimes it's interesting that people who raise these kinds of questions are often attacked as being irreligious, unreligious, that the fact that they would ask these questions are an indication of lack of faith. And sometimes I think that actually asking those questions are not an indication of lack of faith. It's an indication that you want to believe, and yet you're having a hard time wrapping your head around some of these questions. And it seems to me that sometimes some of these questions are only questions that a person of faith would think to ask in the first place.
Yeah, well, you know, people of faith believe, as a rule, that God has given them their intelligence, and surely he means them to use their intelligence. And so people of faith should be thinking people of faith. The option to being a thinking person of faith is to be an ignorant person of faith, and who wants to be ignorant? So I think that, in fact, it's much better to question and to think and to explore, and if it leads to doubt, well, so be it. You know, one doesn't need to be afraid of the truth. If the truth leads you in a certain direction, that's the direction you ought to go.
Yeah. And I think just also to make sure people kind of know where you're coming from, what you call yourself an agnostic. I kind of got a chuckle at that point in the book when you were saying, well, to say that you were an atheist would be going further than you think that you can, because you know, if someone asked the question, does God exist? You'd say, well, I don't know.
Exactly.
And if you were going to the point where you're going to say definitely, no, there is no God, and we don't have an answer to that question either. And it sounds like what you're saying is that's yet another one of these questions that you personally feel, no, I don't have an answer for that question for you.
Yeah, well, I certainly do not believe any longer in the Christian God that I used to believe in. I used to believe in a God who intervened in history and who answered prayer and was actively involved in my life. And I simply don't believe a God like that exists. So that's why some people really want me to come out and say that I'm an atheist, because I don't believe in that God. But for me, the question is there some kind of greater superior force in the universe that I can't fathom? Well, I don't know. I can't fathom it. And so if there is, I simply am ignorant of it. And so I prefer calling myself an agnostic rather than making some kind of definitive declaration that I know, that somehow I know that there's no God. I don't know that one way or the other.
Hmm. We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and our guest is Bart Ehrman. He is James A. Gray, Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's a leading authority on the early church and the life of Jesus. He's the author of more than 20 books, including the bestseller Misquoting Jesus, and his most recent, the book that we're talking about here this morning, is God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. It's published by Harper One, which is a division of HarperCollins. We have some other callers here to talk with. Let's next go to Shelbyville and line 3. Hello.
Yes, I was curious about if your point of view is close to some of the French philosophers or German philosophers, or Sartre, or in the existentialism, based on where your conclusions lead, that we should be focused on, you know, the now and what we can do to improve things. That's kind of one comment. Another comment I'd like to mention is that, you know, we talk about Mother Teresa and how she might have been a saint, but she had so many doubts. But she did continue on with her work, even though she had a lot of doubts about God and whether or not she was being helped by God and questioning God and whatever. I'd like to hear some of your comments about these things.
Yeah, no, happy to comment. Thank you. It's there are a number of philosophers that I find to be very important. And in the history of the discussion of suffering, of course, philosophy has been quite prominent. The technical term for the problem of suffering is the term theodicy, which was actually invented by a German philosopher named Leibniz during the Enlightenment. Leibniz came up with this term theodicy by combining two Greek words that literally mean God's justice. And the question is, how can God be just given the state of the world? And Leibniz struggled with this and came up with his own set of solutions. In more modern times, you're right, there have been a number of French philosophers, Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, for example, who struggled with what it means to exist in this world and developed this philosophy that is often called existentialism. And I suppose at the end of the day, my own views of the world and life is very close to an existentialist point of view. I think that there's not, I don't believe in a God who's in control of this world, and I don't think that meaning resides in the existence of this God. I think that we are all that there is, and I think that this life we have is all there is. I don't think our life is a dry run for something else or a dress rehearsal for something that's going to come later. I think this is it, and so we really ought to make the most of it, make the most of the present as we can, because this is all we're going to have. It is interesting about Mother Teresa and her many doubts. What is most striking, I think, is that she continued her work, and that she, even though she was plagued by doubts, she was intent on relieving suffering in the world. And, of course, not all of us can become Mother Teresa, but I think all of us can probably do more than we're doing, and all of us should do more than we're doing to try and alleviate suffering, both on, you know, local suffering, suffering of people around us, but also on the national and international level. We ought to be giving more. We ought to be volunteering more. We simply ought to be doing more to try and solve these problems of suffering.
Yeah. I think it's important for people to get the right idea, or not to get the wrong idea about you, that it's not that you're advocating for hedonism, that you are saying, yes, that there's nothing wrong with taking some pleasure in life, but that at the same time, that shouldn't be one's exclusive pursuit, and that if you're concerned about suffering, then what you ought to do is whatever you can do in your life to alleviate suffering.
Yeah, that's right. When I was a believer, I had fears about becoming an non-believer because I thought it would lead to a completely hedonistic lifestyle. It turns out I was completely wrong about that. My life is pretty much, the externals of my life are pretty much like what they were before, only I seem to enjoy it more. I still enjoy good food, and I enjoy good drink, and I enjoy watching sports, and I just enjoy life. I think I enjoy it more because I think this is all there is to it. But it certainly hasn't led me to become a hedonist. I also think, though, that while we try and grab for all we can in life, we really need to be concerned that other people have it very hard. And we need to do more in order to try and solve the problems that people are facing around the world.
All right, let's talk again. I appreciate the last caller. Again, we'll go on to another, and this would be line 2 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
The issue of suffering is central in Buddhism. And have you considered Buddhism in this important matter of suffering?
Yeah, thanks for the question. A lot of people have asked me this, and Buddhism is, of course, centered around suffering, not so much to give an answer of why they're suffering as to give people ways of coping with suffering or dealing with suffering on the assumption that all of us suffer, which is, I think, absolutely fundamentally true of the human condition, that it is impossible to be a human and not to suffer. And Buddhism provides ways of dealing with that. I don't deal with that in my book. because I was interested simply in dealing with what the Christian, Jewish, and Christian Bibles say about suffering. Because I'm not a scholar of Buddhism or of other religions. I'm a scholar of Christianity, and my expertise is in the Bible. So I decided to write about what I actually knew about, as opposed to writing about what I don't know about. And so I absolutely think people should look into Buddhism if they are exploring. But it's not something that I deal with in my book.
All right, and then we'll continue. And next caller would be also in Urbana, line one. Hello.
As a kid, one of my first introductions to this whole business of suffering was the bit about Eve and her influence on suffering for women bearing children. And I think it was my mother at that point believed in this stuff and gave me this line, in preparation for having my first periods. And I was a kid who had difficult, painful periods. And I thought, you know, this is not fair. Why should I be paying for something that some person way back years ago, I didn't like that idea of God. And it was probably one of the early seeds of my questioning. And later on, as I studied biology, which is my major in college, and just looked around, I thought to myself, you know, why is it that human beings have such a hard time giving birth when I don't see other animals having difficulties? Unless you're talking about animals that are that human beings have interfered with in their genetics by breeding odd sorts of critters. I finally found the answer to this business. A local faculty member at the U of I is one of the authors of the book, The Invisible Sex, and she was on WYLL last year, got the book and read it and was fascinated. And one of the things she talks about, along with her other authors, is why it is that human beings are the only ones who need assistance, who are likely to need assistance during childbirth. And it's because we became bipedal, changed our pelvic structure, and also because of the large size of babies' heads. They show the evolution of the pelvic structure, especially compared to chimpanzees and I forget what else. But there's right there. You know.
That's great. Yeah, you know, I think that these biological evolutionary answers are probably more satisfying than the answer given in Genesis, which the answer in Genesis is actually a little bit strange when you think about it, that because Eve gave Adam the fruit to eat, then Eve's curse was that she would experience pain during childbearing. But it makes you wonder what the option was going to be before she gave the fruit. I mean, you know, I guess that childbearing would be pain-free somehow, but that's a little bit hard to imagine.
Yeah. Again, I hope the caller will forgive me. Just got about 5 minutes left, and my lines are full, and I would like to try to get some more folks here into the conversation. So next, we'll go on to Edgar County, line four. Hello.
Welcome to the club. I don't use the word agnostic, and I don't use the word atheist. I use the larger description of a secular existential humanist, and I believe that makes most people muddled, so they don't ask me anything more. But situation is, what is the way that we deal with people when we're trying to explain that we do have a belief?
That's a great point. You know, I live in North Carolina, which is in very much in the Bible Belt. And in my part of the world, secular humanist is a four-letter word.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
So the problem with the term agnostic is what you're pointing out, that it's a negation. It's saying you don't know, but it doesn't say anything positive about what you think. And
well, but I say to people when they ask me, well, you know, don't you believe in God? And I said, I don't have the comprehension to be able to understand.
Yeah.
I don't have the intelligence, which,
yeah. Well, you know, when I was an evangelical Christian, we used to say that God is far beyond anything we can imagine.
That's right.
And here's what he's like.
I don't use that.
Then we would
part.
Start describing him. And so now I'm at a point where I think, you know, if God does exist, he really is far beyond anything I can imagine, which means I can't say anything about him.
Right. So, to another point, W.H. Auden, who I was acquainted with, the poet, wrote a poem called For the Time Being, which is about the birth of Christ.
Oh, yeah.
And he had a great deal of guilt about religion, and eventually went to Anglican religion in his later life. But there's one line in there which I think explains everything. The kitchen table exists because I scrub it.
Yeah. Yes, it's hard to deny objective reality when you're scrubbing the table, yes.
We're, again, coming down here, we just have a couple of minutes left. I'm just, this is probably the kind of question you could talk about for a long time, but in this move that you ended up making from being a believing evangelical Christian now to someone who calls yourself agnostic, what do you feel? Do you feel any sense of loss? Is there anything there that you would say, well, you know, I am kind of sorry that there's something that I had to leave behind?
Yeah, absolutely. I deal with this in my book, God's Problem, because I wasn't eager to leave the Christian fold because there was so much there that's rich and valuable. For one thing, being with like-minded people and having fellowship with people and having a community, a loving, supportive community, I think is very important. And having the sense of being sort of embraced within the divine grasp is a very comforting thought, and I think it's difficult to leave behind many aspects of the faith. But when people, you know, when I tell people that I'm an agnostic now, some people tell me they find that to be very sad. But I tell them, actually, I'm a happy agnostic. I think probably I'm happier now than I ever was before, even when I was a believer. Life is very meaningful to me, and it's very rich for me, and so I don't find it to be a sad thing at all, even though there were things that were hard for me to leave behind.
All right, let's go and get at least one more caller. Champagne, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. I am a Christian. I don't attend church. I'm not religious. My father was a Catholic. My mother, Southern Baptist. So I was confused. I tended to go away from the church. I sought to void myself of the teachings, the doctrine of man, the doctrine of the church. And as I read the Bible on a daily basis, which I've been doing for 16, 17 years, I found that if we neglect the fact that there are negative forces, that there is a devil, that Satan exists, if we forget that and don't see the evolution of man, the spiritual evolution of man, where God acted in a carnal sense in the past, you know, split the rock and, you know, parted the waters, whatever, and now acts in a more spiritual way. If we deny the power of the Spirit, the Holy Spirit within us, Jesus said the kingdom is now and it is within you. If we deny these things, that's blaspheming the Spirit. So looking at these carnal aspects of the Bible and negating the power of the Spirit, you know, we don't understand why the man at the switch handle at the river who pulls the plug and dumps the toxins in the river and the people downstream get cancer and they say, what did I do wrong? They didn't. He did. And I just, you know, if you give me your thoughts on that.
Okay, well, yeah, thanks for your interesting reflections. You know, and I think that some of the points you're raising about Satan and the Bible and stuff, I mean, there's certainly parts of the Bible that think that evil is caused by powers of evil like Satan. There are other passages that think that that evil is caused by human beings. This is part of my point, is that different parts of the Bible have different points of view about such things, and it's important to let each author have his own say and to try and understand what each one is trying to emphasize.
All right. Again, I want to try to get one more, and that would be, I believe, in Line number two, and that would be in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, I had one question about the social outcomes of some of these answers. In that one of the communities, local communities, that seems to suffer an awful lot in the United States are African Americans. They have the worst physical health. Some may consider the most, the worst statistics on mental health and even the worst service when it comes to the healthcare system. But at the same time, you have this high level of suffering. You also have a very high level of religious activity in that very same community. There are more churches located in black communities than there are abroad. But you've got this frustration. And I guess my question is it true that other books are offering a much more consistent answer to this question of suffering? And is that dictating why you seem to be losing a lot of people in Christianity and gaining a lot of people, say, in Islam, especially in this community that has an awful lot of suffering going on? I know you're not an Islamic scholar.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's a great question, because a lot of people have asked me this and asked, you know, I get emails from Muslims telling me that, you know, the Bible may have problems, but the Quran has none. Or I get letters from Mormons who tell me that, you know, the New Testament may be a problem, but the Book of Mormon, that's really the thing. I think all of these books probably have problems, but they speak to different needs, and at different moments they're found to be very powerful messages, and many of these books provide a kind of certitude that people are looking for in the midst of their suffering, and the certitude that is very, very seductive for people.
We're going to have to stop, and I want to say I much appreciate all the thoughts offered by callers and also by our guest. If you're interested in reading some more, you can look for the book we mentioned. God's Problem is the title, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer, by our guest Bart Ehrman. And his last name, by the way, is spelled Ehrman. He is the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, author of a number of books. You also might want to take a look at his book, Misquoting Jesus. And there are others. He's authored more than 20. Professor Ehrman, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Our program, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates offers four area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. And that's it for us here on Focus, but we want you to stay tuned. There's much more coming up as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, our guest will be Mark Winney. He's a hunger activist, and we will talk with him about his book, Closing the Food Gap, Resetting the Table in the Land of Plenty. Mark Winney will join us at 1:06 Central Time. Let's turn our attention now to the commodity markets. Well, we're not going to be able to do that at the moment because I've got some kind of a technical glitch going on here. I can't get into the program. So let me tell you that in the WILL severe weather coverage area, an urban and small stream flood warning is in effect for Clark, Cumberland, and southern Edgar counties until 3:30 this afternoon, and a flood watch remains in effect for Champaign, Christian, Clark, Coles, Cumberland, Douglas, Edgar, Macon, Moultrie, Piatt, Shelby, and Vermilion counties until 4 o'clock this afternoon. This is WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois.